and animals, so accurate and complete that modern-day botanists and zoologists have little difficulty in recognizing the species. Only rarely did Lewis use Latin-derived taxonomic botanical words, but his range of knowledge included at least 200 technical botanical terms in English. At Fort Clatsop, he discovered and described in great detail, often hundreds of words, 10 new plants and trees, including the magnificent Sitka spruce. He collected, labeled, and preserved to bring home to Jefferson dozens of plants, leaves, and cones. He demonstrated familiarity with their eastern counterparts by consistently comparing what he was seeing on the west coast with what he remembered from the east coast. Jefferson had ordered Lewis to observe the animals of the country generally, and especially those not known in the U.S. Lewis faithfully obeyed. During that winter, he wrote about some 100 animals altogether. 35 mammals, 50 birds, 10 reptiles and fish, and 5 invertebrates. Of these, 11 birds, 2 fish, and 11 mammals were new to science. In his classic study, Lewis and Clark, Pioneering Naturalists, Paul Russell Cutright points out that, though Lewis used a minimum of technical words in his description of new birds, he nevertheless applied adequate data on color, shape of wings, number and length of tail feathers, color of iris, and note. Lewis also provided detailed descriptions of how things were done, ranging from Indian methods of preparing fish and roots to the making of canoes. On January 7th, when Drouillard brought in a fat beaver, most welcome as food, Lewis asked him how the castor or bait was prepared for the traps. He used over 500 words to describe the process as Drouillard explained it to him. You could prepare a castor and place it correctly on a trap today from Lewis's description. Some of Lewis's portraits were of animals he had encountered in the mountains, not native to the lower Columbia. For example, he wrote about Franklin's grouse, which he said he had not seen since leaving the mountains. This was another indication that he had not written in his journal while crossing the Nez Perce Trail. Jefferson has been criticized for not sending a trained naturalist on the expedition. Donald Jackson will have none of that. If a botanist, he asks, why not also a zoologist and perhaps a geologist? Later, the government could send out such specialists. Now the problem was to get a few men to the Pacific and back, encumbered no more than necessary by equipment, and intelligent enough to recognize and collect, but not necessarily to evaluate, the natural resources of the region. Cutright goes further. Lewis was blessed with capabilities often missing in naturalists, particularly an outstanding inherent observational competence, an all-inclusive interest, and an objective, systematic, philosophical approach to understanding the natural world. Nothing refutes Lewis's self-appraisal as a botanist, and deprecating remarks of others more eloquently than his own abundant writing. In the context of the day, Lewis was an unusually capable naturalist, one with an attitude more consistent with scientists of the 20th century than with those of his own. While Lewis described birds, plants, animals, and methods, Clark worked on his map, covering the country from Fort Mandan to Fort Clatsop. On February 11th, he finished the work, an invaluable contribution to the world's knowledge. Together with his previous map of the lower Missouri, it brought the American West together for the first time. The map was Clark's work, but the implications of it were a subject of intense discussion between the captains. For 2 months, they talked about what they had seen for themselves and learned from the Indians. The result, in the opinion of geographer John Logan Allen, was the most important product of their winter on the Pacific. We now discover, Lewis wrote on February 14th, after 3 days of going over the completed map with Clark, that we have found the most practicable and navigable passage across the continent of North America. That note, almost triumphant, hid a deep disappointment. The real headline news from the Lewis and Clark expedition was that there was no all-water route across the continent. The short portage from the Missouri to the Columbia did not exist. This negation of the passage to India, Allen writes, the feature of all images of the American Northwest since Marquette, was the greatest single transformation of geographical lore for which the journey of Lewis and Clark was responsible. The best route fell far short of Jefferson's hopes. That was the answer Lewis was going to have to give to the first question Jefferson would ask when they met next year. Beyond his personal feelings, Jefferson would have to pay a political price. With the Sioux blocking the Missouri, and with no all-water route across the continent, the Federalists would have a peg upon which to ridicule the Louisiana Purchase. At Fort Clatsop, Lewis started practicing how he would present the news. That business about the best route made for a positive start. He went on to claim that, just as Jefferson had anticipated, the best route was up the Missouri and down the Columbia, the route the expedition had followed. Except for the two shortcuts from the Missouri, at the gates of the mountains and at the Great Falls, which the Shoshones and Nez Perce had told the captains about, these they intended to explore on the return trip. As for crossing the Bitterroot Mountains, Lewis explained that Indian information convinced him it would not be possible to go north or south to find a better passage than the Nez Perce Trail. He recorded without comment that it was a distance of 184 miles. Not much of a best route, but the reality of geography could not be wished away. In a little-known letter dated September 29, 1806, Lewis came a bit closer to recognizing that reality than he had in his Fort Clatsop entry. In it, he wrote that he had no hesitation to say and declare that the expedition had been completely successful in discovering the most practicable route, but then added the crucial qualifier, such as nature has permitted. For the men of the Enlightenment, there was no arguing with nature. Surely Jefferson would be unhappy with the end of his dream, but still glad to know the truth. And the truth was that Jefferson would have to put out of his mind forever any comparison between the Rocky Mountains and the Appalachians. Sitting on his rough-hewn stool at his rough-hewn desk at Fort Clatsop, Lewis could imagine sitting in the drawing room at the President's house, reporting to Jefferson. He could imagine Jefferson taking in the news, nodding, accepting the fact, and already beginning to think of how to deal with the newly discovered reality. Lewis could suppose that, after getting some details, Jefferson might well ask about the commercial possibilities. Could Americans establish a trading post at the mouth of the Columbia and take over from the British the fabulously profitable fur trade with the Orient? Lewis was working on a plan to bring that about, but it had not yet matured. He revealed one part of it, however, by noting that the abundance and cheapness of horses among the natives on both sides of the mountains will be extremely advantageous to those who may hereafter attempt the fur trade to the East Indies by way of the Columbia River and the Pacific Ocean. The length and difficulty of the portage over that route could be overcome with readily available horses from tribes that had no contact with the British. He gave a census of the horse holdings of the Shoshone, the Nez Perce, and other tribes, all of whom enjoy the benefit of that docile, generous, and valuable animal, the horse. The British had to take their furs out the St. Lawrence and on to London before they could begin the voyage to the Indies. If only a man could figure out how to get a trading post established on the Columbia and a way to get the furs from the Canadian and the American Great Plains to it, American businessmen would have a one-year advantage over their British rivals. Lewis continued to think about that larger problem. But there would be no person-to-person report to Jefferson if Lewis did not get himself and his party home. He prepared accordingly. He checked the supplies, especially the rifles and ammunition. Now our only hope for subsistence and defense in a route of 4,000 miles through a country exclusively inhabited by savages. He found there was more than enough and congratulated himself on having come up with that happy expedient which I devised of securing the powder by means of the lead. The lead canisters had been through many adventures, but were little damaged. The powder was dry. Moccasins were being made. The rifles were all in order, thanks to John Shields's skills. Lewis had determined to stay at Fort Clatsop until April 1st, but on March 5th he indicated he wanted to move the date forward. For one thing, like everyone else, he wanted to get out of the place. For another, the elk were farther away than ever, making life even more difficult. By mid-March, Lewis had fixed March 20th as departure day. It came and went. The wind blew so violently the Americans dared not attempt the river in their canoes. Still, Lewis used the occasion to say goodbye to Fort Clatsop. His statement was objective and philosophical, and had just a bit of nostalgia to it. Although we have not fared sumptuously this winter at Fort Clatsop, we have lived quite as comfortably as we had any reason to expect we should, and have accomplished every object which induced our remaining at this place. In making the preparations for departure, Lewis set out to purchase a couple of native canoes to use in going up the river as far as the lowest falls. On March 14th, he bargained with the Clatsop over an indifferent canoe, but Lewis thought the price was more than our stock of merchandise would license us. I offered him my laced uniform coat, but he would not exchange. The expedition was desperately poor, almost broke. Two handkerchiefs would not contain all the small articles of merchandise which we possess, Lewis lamented on March 16th. The balance of the stock consists of 6 blue robes, 1 uniform artillerist's coat and hat, 5 robes made of our large flag, and a bit of ribbon. On this stock, he realized, we have wholly to depend for the purchase of horses and such portion of our subsistence from the Indians as it will be in our powers to obtain. Thinking it over, he added, a scant dependence indeed for a tour of the distance of that before us. But there wouldn't be any crossing of the mountains if the party couldn't get to the falls of the Columbia first, and to get there, Lewis needed Indian canoes. On March 17th, he sent Driard with his prized coat to pay the price demanded by the Indian owner of the canoe he wanted. He complained in his journal that the Indians valued their canoes too highly, and noted, I think the United States are indebted to me another uniform coat, for that of which I have disposed on this occasion was but little worn. His poverty and his great need for another canoe put him in a foul and desperate mood. He made a decision and came up with a rationalization to justify it. We yet want another canoe, and as the Clatsops will not sell us one at a price which we can afford to give, we will take one of them in lieu of the 6 elk which they stole from us in the winter. He did not point out that the Clatsops had paid for the stolen elk with dogs. On March 18th, the deed was done. Lewis did not record it, but Sergeant Ordway noted in his journal that 4 men went over to the prairie near the coast and took a canoe, as we are in want of it. When they got it back to the fort, they found that Chief Cobaway was visiting, so they hid it. Lewis admitted that the deception of Cobaway set a little awkward, but he covered his crime by giving the chief a certificate of his good conduct and the friendly intercourse which he has maintained with us during our residence at this place. James Rhonda rightly characterizes this as a particularly sordid tale of deception and friendship betrayed, at worst criminal and at best a terrible lapse of judgment. The essential honesty that distinguished Lewis and Clark from explorers like Hernando de Soto and Francisco Pizarro had been tarnished. Lewis felt he had no choice. Perhaps he was right. Perhaps the expedition's poverty did preclude purchase. Surely the Clatsops would have taken a rifle and some ammunition and powder for a canoe, but giving a rifle to a native would have involved a violation of an absolute rule, just as stealing a canoe did. Lewis chose to steal. During Cobaway's March 18th visit, Lewis had given him, with copies to other chiefs who visited that day, a list of the names of the men in the Corps of Discovery. He posted another copy in his quarters, explaining in a preamble that the object of this list is that through the medium of some civilized person who may see the same, it may be made known to the informed world that the party consisting of the persons named, and who were sent out by the government of the United States in May 1804 to explore the interior of the continent of North America, did penetrate the same to the Pacific Ocean. On the back of the lists, Clark added a sketched map of the Missouri and Columbia. Lewis felt that the chances that a copy of the journals would get from the Clatsops to a trading vessel and then on to Washington were too small to take the risk. Likewise, Jefferson's idea of sending 1 or 2 men home on a trading vessel with a copy of the journals and reports. Our party are also too small to think of leaving any of them to return to the United States by sea, Lewis wrote, particularly as we shall be necessarily divided into 3 or 4 parties on our return in order to accomplish the objects, exploration of alternative routes, we have in view. Anyway, it was highly unlikely that a trader who had to go around the world to reach the east coast of the United States could get there before the captains arrived. And there were no ships in the area. Leaving 2 men to wait on the chance that 1 would arrive soon was not practical. On March 22nd, the storm began to slack off, and the party prepared to push off in the morning. That day, Cobaway paid a parting visit. Lewis gave him our houses and furniture, a generous gesture, even if he had no other option. He wrote of Kabaway, in whose canoe he was about to depart, "He has been much more kind and hospitable to us than any other Indian in this neighborhood." Then came the last words he wrote during his long, wet winter at Fort Clatsop. Appropriately, they were botanical. "The leafing of the huckleberry reminds us of spring." Spring in Virginia, that is, where he intended to be when the leaves started to come out in 1807. Chapter 26. Jefferson and the West, 1804 to 1806. From the spring of 1804 until the summer of the following year, President Jefferson had no direct communication with Lewis. People of that era accepted such anxiety. Much as he wanted to know about the safety, progress, and discoveries of the expedition, there was nothing Jefferson could do. He could not issue any orders, provide any warnings, consult on any decisions. He could only wait and hope. In July 1804, Jefferson got his first return on the investment in the Corps of Discovery. A delegation of 14 Osage Indians from present-day Missouri, whom Lewis had convinced to make the journey in April, arrived in Washington. Captain Stoddard made the final arrangements. Horses, food, shelter, and soldiers for guides and security made it an expensive trip, but the often penny-pinching president considered it a good investment. "The truth is," he wrote Secretary of War Dearborn, "the Osages are the great nation south of the Missouri, their possession extending from thence to the Red River, as the Sioux are great north of that river. With these two powerful nations we must stand well, because in their quarter we are miserably weak." The representatives of the Osage Nation arrived on July 11th, which chanced to be the day of the Burr-Hamilton duel at Weehawken. The Osage men impressed Jefferson mightily. "They are the finest men we have ever seen." They were gigantic, he said, and noted with high approval that they were unused to spirituous liquor. He intended to win their loyalty through a combination of bribes and threats, the traditional American Indian policy. "We shall endeavor to impress them strongly, not only with our justice and liberality," he wrote, "but with our power." St. Louis businessman and friend of Lewis, Pierre Chouteau, accompanied the Osages as interpreter and general manager of the tour. Chouteau had his eye on the main chance. He met with Secretary of the Treasury, Albert Gallatin, who sized him up thus: "He seems well disposed, but what he wants is power and money." He asked for a monopoly on the Indian trade west of the Mississippi. "I told him this was inadmissible, and his last demand was the exclusive trade with the Osages. As he may be either useful or dangerous, I gave no flat denial." Thus did the intense competition between frontier businessmen for the Indian trade continue under new management. The Chouteau family, along with Manuel Lisa, Joseph Robidoux, and others, were adept at currying favor with corrupt Spanish bureaucrats for precious trading licenses with the Western tribes. And no wonder. It was the most immediate and by far the most profitable source of wealth in the trans-Mississippi West. There was a ritual to the Indians' visits. They were taken to the cities, Philadelphia, New York, Boston. Some cannon were fired for their edification, troops paraded, and then they called on the president. Jefferson's speech to the Osages, given in the president's house, was typical. "You have furs and peltries which we want," he said after announcing that he was their new father, "and we have useful things which you want." But a mutually beneficial commerce could not begin until the United States knew more about the Osages and their country. "For this purpose I sent a beloved man, Captain Lewis, one of my own household, to learn something of the people with whom we are now united, to let you know we were your friends, to invite you to come and see us, and to tell us how we can be useful to you." When Lewis returned, "We shall hear what he has seen and learnt, and proceed to establish trading houses where our red brethren shall think best, and to exchange commodities with them." Jefferson went on in a passage that is almost poetry. "It is so long since our forefathers came from beyond the great water that we have lost the memory of it, and seem to have grown out of this land as you have done. We are all now of one family, born in the same land, and bound to live as brothers, and the strangers from beyond the great water are gone from among us. The Great Spirit has given you strength and has given us strength, not that we might hurt one another, but to do each other all the good in our power. He concluded, "No wrong will ever be done you by our nation." 2 weeks later, and more than 1,000 miles west, Lewis made the same points in his speech to the Otoes, and persuaded Chief Little Thief, 2 other Otoes, 3 Pawnees, and a Missouri Indian to visit the president. In the fall of 1804, the Osages returned to St. Louis, thence on to their homes on the Osage River. According to Major James Bruff, who had replaced Captain Stoddard as commandant of the newly created Department of Upper Louisiana, they were puffed up with ideas of their great superiority to other nations because of all the presents they had been given and the attention lavished on them. That same fall, Jefferson began to get garbled reports on Lewis's progress. On November 6th, he wrote Reuben Lewis, "I have the pleasure to inform you we have lately received through a channel meriting entire confidence, advice that on the 4th of August he, Lewis, was at the mouth of the River Platte, 600 miles up the Missouri. 2 of his men had deserted from him." According to the informant, Lewis's plans were to send 1 of his boats and 1/2 the men back to St. Louis before winter set in. In the spring, he would leave 1/2 the remaining men with the Mandans to make corn for his return, and would proceed with the rest to cross the mountains and journey to the Pacific. That was sketchy and only about half true, but it was something. Jefferson, typically thoughtful, sent it on to Lewis's brother so that Reuben might inform his mother that her oldest son was safe so far. On November 5th, Major Bruff passed on an